Let's continue our look at this very busy day in Jesus' Galilean ministry by opening to Mark chapter 4, verse number 35, where it tells us that on that day, when evening had come, he said to them, "Let us go across to the other side." Now that follows the sermon in parables that we were talking about yesterday. The sermon in parables follows some events that happen in a house near the seashore, which in turn followed the sermon we call the Sermon on the Mount, which followed Jesus appointing his 12 apostles, which followed him praying all night up on the hillside, which followed him doing ministry on the North Shore. So we have been very, very, very busy with Jesus on this day near the beginning of his second year of ministry. But what happens here is Mark gives us the chronological anchor from which we can readjust our understanding of the chronology in the Gospel of Matthew. Because before he takes off to go to the other side, he has a chat with some would-be disciples. So I want to go to Matthew chapter 8, verse 18 now. Matthew 8, 18. "Now when Jesus saw a great crowd around him, he gave orders to go to the other side," meaning the other side of the Sea of Galilee, the Lake of Gennesaret. Verse 19, "A scribe came up." Now, scribes were professional writers. They were paid in order to write out in the best possible handwriting documents. Now, a lot of scribes hand-copied scripture scrolls. This scribe, because they were well acquainted with scripture, was wanting to express his desire to follow Jesus as Messiah. So a scribe came up and said to him, "Teacher, I will follow you wherever you go." So I want to follow you right now. Verse 20, "Jesus said to him, 'Foxes have holes,'" or dens, places where they sleep and take care of their young. "'Birds of the air have nests,'" which they do the same thing. That's where they rest. That's where they raise their young. "'But the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head.'" Now, Jesus has been sleeping probably in the rough, probably on a bedroll out in the wilds, but from time to time, he slept in houses. His point is that he has no fixed residence. He is itinerant. He is wandering. And so this guy should understand, if he's going to follow Jesus at this moment, he needs to be ready to go on the move. Verse 21, "Another of his disciples said to him," and so what we find out here is this one guy's conversation with Jesus about potentially becoming a follower then gives the writer, Matthew, a chance to talk about some other people that had offered to be followers of Jesus but seemed to have some things that were holding them back at this point. Luke tells these stories in Luke chapter number 9. So let's look at potential disciple number 2. "Another disciple said to him, 'Lord, let me first go and bury my father.' And Jesus said to him, 'Follow me, let the dead leave the dead to bury their own dead.'" Now some people feel that that's really cold-hearted of Jesus. Why won't he let the man go to his dad's funeral? That is not what's happening here. The Jewish procedure was you buried your dead relative the same day they died. So if this man's dad had actually died, He would be at the funeral right now, not with Jesus. So that's not what's being talked about here. He is actually saying, I want to follow you, but I need to wait until my dad has passed from the scene, which could be weeks, months, years even. And so Jesus' response to him is, you need to just follow me, and you let the spiritually dead take care of burying the physical dead. All right, so what do we learn from these two passages? I don't think we should over-apply them to our own circumstances, because the first guy was actually being told by Jesus, when you follow me, you're not going to have a place, a regular place to sleep. That's not always the case nowadays. Some missionaries, some itinerant evangelists and people like that do continually move around. But most of us who are Christians, we stay in the same place. And so that's not always the case that we have to be ready to be on the run all the time. But the other guy, he does illustrate something that we can learn from. And that is, sometimes we want to put off getting serious about our relationship with Jesus Christ. And Jesus' response to that is, no, if you're going to make the choice, you need to make it now. Later in the book of Hebrews, we'll see this application of today is the day of salvation. Now, right now is the time to make your decision. And so we need to encourage people that might express some sort of, I need to do a few more things the way I want to do them, and then I'll be willing to become a follower of Jesus. We need them to understand, no, if you're serious about becoming a follower of Jesus, you need to start now, ASAP, and let him help you decide how to do the rest of your life. Okay, so the next thing that happens in Matthew chapter 8, verse 23, is the same thing that happens in Mark chapter 4 and in Luke chapter 8. And that is the calming of the storm on the sea. So Matthew 8, 23, when he got into the boat, his disciples followed him. The Mark passage puts it this way, 4:36, it says, leaving the crowd, they took him with them in the boat just as he was, and other boats were with them, or with him. So basically, once he's finished with the day of preaching from the boat, he pretty much says, let's go. We need to go to the other side. Which is not all that far. The place that they will end up landing, based on where I think they started out, is only about 5 or 6 miles across the sea. And so, something happens, though. It says, behold, I'm back in the Matthew passage, sorry, Matthew 8, 24. Behold, there arose a great storm on the sea, so that the boat was being swamped by the waves, but he was asleep. So they are making the crossing when a storm rolls down, probably out of the Golan. And these storms are bad. And it's pretty windy out on the Sea of Galilee as it is. But if you've got one of these storms that rolls off of the high country to the east and northeast of the Sea of Galilee, it churns up the sea big time. And it will swamp any of these boats that the fishermen used. And so they did not like to be caught in one of these flash storms. And this one apparently is really, really bad. Now, Jesus is so exhausted, and we shouldn't be surprised by that. He has not slept for probably 36 hours or more. And so he is totally zonked. He is all the way out in the stern of the boat when this storm hits. And the waves are lapping up over the edges of the boat and filling the bottom of it so fast that they cannot bail it quickly enough. And so the threat level here is that if enough volume of water gets into the floor of the boat, it will lose its buoyancy and it will completely just sink into the depths of the Sea of Galilee. And so they, verse 25 says, they went and woke him, saying, "Save us, Lord, we're perishing." The other passage, Mark chapter 4, verse number 38 says, they woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care that we're perishing?" And then over in Luke chapter 8, verse 24, they went and woke him saying, "Master, Master, we're perishing." And so these guys are in a blind panic, which should tell you how bad this is. Because at least four of them, possibly more, are professional fishermen. They work on this lake all the time. They know it well. They know its moods. They know its weather patterns. And these guys are pretty certain they are toast. They are dead. And they are asking Jesus to jump up and do a miracle. They can't believe he's sleeping during this. And he's going to get them a greater miracle than what they were expecting. He said to them, verse 26 of Matthew 8, "Why are you afraid, O you of little faith?" Now, I want you to think about this. If Jesus is on the boat, and Jesus is Messiah, Jesus is Son of God, is that boat going to sink? Is God going to allow Jesus to be assassinated by the storm? And the answer, of course, is no. So Jesus is chiding these guys for losing their faith in the middle of this storm, for forgetting that when God is using you, you're indestructible. If he's got a plan for you that has not yet come to its fruition, you're indestructible. So Jesus' time has not yet come, so there is no way in the world he's going to drown in this storm. And since they're with him, they should be fine. So the little faith thing is something that he appears to coin. I don't think I've ever seen it in any other materials previous to the Gospels. It's just little faith, little believers. Then he rose and rebuked the winds and the sea, and there was a great calm. We actually have the wording over in Mark's gospel. It says in chapter number 4, verse number 39, and remember that Mark seems to be writing down everything in Peter's sermons. And so this is Peter's eyewitness account. It says that he said, "Peace." So shalom, perhaps. "Peace, be still." Some of those that are really big into trying to dig into the vocabulary of the New Testament have taken note that the formulation that is used here is found elsewhere in the Middle East around this same time as the way people treated their pets when they were misbehaving. "Shut up, sit down." And so Jesus was basically telling the sea, "Knock it off, lay down and be quiet." Now, the calm that happens is noted by the Gospels. Matthew says that it was a great calm. One moment, there is winds going on like crazy, and the waves are bouncing at the ship everywhere. And the next moment, the winds are gone, and the waves flatten out. And Matthew says in 8:37, the men marveled. They were shocked. Mark's gospel says they were filled with great fear. They were scared to death. They were scared by the storm to begin with. And now they're scared by Jesus because they've never seen anything like this before. Matthew has them saying, what sort of man is this that even the winds and the sea obey him? Because he treated the sea like a disobedient pet, and it obeyed. It rolled over and showed its belly. And they'd never seen anything like that before. This is probably a good place to bring up for you something that I have become more and more convinced of. And that is that the disciples seem to have grown up in the Jewish religious culture that believed that the Messiah would be a super prophet, like Moses, or like Elijah, or Elisha. But they didn't understand, they did not comprehend that it was actually going to be God in the flesh. They did not realize that Jesus is, in fact, the Creator in human form. So, of course, the wind and the waves have to obey him. He created weather. And so, eventually, they will figure this out. I think the first guy that actually expresses it is Thomas on the eighth day after the resurrection, when he is offered the chance to put his fingers into the nail prints that are still in Jesus' hands and feet, and to even put his hand into that wound that is in Jesus' side, which didn't keep him dead. And his response is, my Lord and my God. So at this point, these guys may just now start figuring out that Jesus is even more than just the super prophet they were looking to come. Matthew chapter 8, verse number 28. When he came to the other side, to the country of the Gadarenes. Now, this is a little bit confusing here, and I think it has something to do with the similarity of place names that scribes had to deal with over time. Matthew has Gadarenes. Mark chapter 5, verse 1, has Gerasenes. And same thing is found in Luke chapter 8, 26. Now, Gadara, there is a Gadara that is one of the Decapolis cities, but it is not on the Sea of Galilee shore. It's off to the southeast, quite a few miles. So that can't be the one that we're talking about. And Gerasene doesn't have any specific places that we know historically, but there is a place called Kursi, which is very close in sign or in sounds to Gerson. And Kursi is located on the east shore of the Sea of Galilee, just a few miles south of the mouth of the Jordan Valley, or the Jordan River that flows into the north end of the Sea of Galilee. If you look at a map of the Sea of Galilee, there is like a bay area that's been filled in with sedimentation over the years on the northeast corner of the Sea of Galilee. If you're looking at modern-day Sea of Galilee, you can see a road that goes around that little flat area. Well, Kersey is just about a mile and a half, 2 miles south of that flat area. And that seems to be the town that we're talking about here, Kersey. It's, I think, spelled today K-U-R-S-I, something of that nature. So you can look it up. So there was eventually a chapel built in the 4th century at Kersey that was associated with this event. Now, the event itself actually happens a little farther south of Kersey, where the slope of the hill country of the Golan dumps down at a steep angle into the Sea of Galilee. And there is a road cut that kind of disrupts a little bit of that slope. But it is a very steep gradient that goes down into the sea just south of the village of Kersey. And it's not a cliff, even though we might see cliffs used in some of our Bibles. It's actually a very steep slope. All right, so back to, I think, Matthew's Gospel. Now, let's go to Mark's Gospel and use it. Mark chapter 5, verse 2. When Jesus had stepped out of the boat, so he gets out of the boat, not on a dock, but on the shore, because they're trying to avoid cities. They're trying to avoid towns. So they have come to shore on an area near the cemetery for Kersey. So when Jesus had stepped out of the boat, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit. Now we've talked about demon possession. Demon possession, as we see it here in the Gospels, is actually the terminal relationship between a human being and a spirit being. It starts out voluntary on the part of the human, but over time, the human may want to get out of the relationship, and the demon becomes abusive and even makes the person hurt themselves or others and just causes all sorts of trouble. Basically, if I can't have you, nobody gets you. Nobody's going to like you. When I'm done with you, everybody will despise you. That sort of attitude. Now, Matthew actually tells us there are two people here at the tombs area in this situation. But we are going to focus on the senior member of those two, the guy that's got the biggest problem, the guy that's apparently entered into many more relationships with demons. He must have really been involved in the occult. And so now he is in a mess. So here is a description of him. Verse 3. He lived among the tombs. No one could bind him anymore, not even with a chain, for he had often been bound with shackles and chains, but he wrenched the chains apart and he broke the shackles to pieces. No one had the strength to subdue him. So he'd apparently been very aggressive. People had tried to chain him up. But the demonic beings that have control of his endocrine system have pumped him full of adrenaline at those times and managed to break the chains off. And so they finally gave up trying to keep him chained. So he just wanders around in this tomb area and apparently has been joined by another guy in a similar situation. Verse 5, night and day among the tombs and on the mountains, that's the hills going up into the Golan, he was always crying out and bruising himself with stones. I'm going to suggest to you that that's probably the person reacting physically to this demonic abuse, trying to cut himself open to either let the demons out or maybe even end his own life. And so the demons make him where he can't get that done. And so this is really messed up. And so verse number 6, when he saw Jesus from afar, he ran and fell down before him. And crying out with a loud voice, he said, "What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High? The Most High God, I adjure you by God, don't torment me." Now, another thing about demon possession that we've talked about is we have more than one entity that's involved here. We've got the human person who still has some vestiges of free will. And then we've got the demonic entity, or in this case, entities, that are trying to force the human to come back under their full voluntary control. And so the human can go places on their own, but as they go, the demons are going to be going with them. So I believe that the human spots Jesus coming to shore. The demons inside understand exactly who Jesus is. And because of that knowledge flowing into the human rushes to Jesus. Because what is it that needs to happen in an abusive demonic relationship for freedom? There needs to be an authoritative third party step in. And so I believe this human may have recognized at the panic of the demons, that guy down there at the shore is somebody that can help me. And so he runs down to him and falls down in front. Come back tomorrow and we'll continue this story.